Our first problem, then, is the fact that school closes in 20 minutes. So, as I said, my inclination is to just keep talking until we reach our normal end time, but of course that would be unfair to people who want to leave. So I think I will just keep talking, and then if you want to get up and leave at 2:30, feel free, go right ahead, I won't be insulted. But before you leave, let me point out that there is no class on Thursday, because I have to be someplace else. The quiz that you would have on Thursday will be next Tuesday, which is the 10th, I believe, of February. And we will go on to, actually, maybe we won't, because the next week we'll be talking about statements, which is Chapter 3. The stuff in there should be really familiar. It should be pretty much straightforward translation from your previous experience in C++. So maybe what I will do is drag the lectures that we were supposed to talk about this week, drag them into next week. I'll have to see. I'll take a look. In fact, that thought just occurred to me, so I'll have to take a look and see if that's a practical thing to do.
What does that quiz cover? Like, what chapter?
It will cover Chapter 4. Your quizzes are back. I'm trying something new in my never-ending effort to make things way harder than they should be. And perhaps also as a tribute to David Foster Wallace. I haven't put any comments on your quiz, as you notice. Usually I'll write comments on your quiz. The comments are on the web page. If you're familiar with the way I started doing quizzes on the web last semester, I would write down people's answers. The people in 306, I didn't... Oh, wait a minute, what was it? Yeah, I think maybe the people in 306, there were only three people there, so I didn't do it there because it's pretty easy to figure out whose answer is who. So I didn't do it there. But I did do it in 503 because there, or sorry, 305, because there are enough people there that it's kind of hard to figure it out. And six people, it's probably kind of hard to figure it out too. So I'm doing it this semester in this class. The comments, you have to find your own answer and then look and see what the comments are. But I did that just to, I don't know why, because it makes it harder, and it looks like David Foster Wallace. So. And I'll probably keep doing that until I get tired of it, and then we'll do something else. Although I don't know what. I actually kind of enjoyed doing that, too. I had the right macros for doing the footnoting stuff. I still have to write some more macros because it's a little complicated to do it now. I'm trying to make it even easier. Of course, then it'll break and nothing will work, and it'll give me something else I have to fix. Let's see. So no class on Thursday, just did that. What we're going to do for the rest of the today, more or less, did that. And I believe that's all I had to talk about. Oh, I have not been taking attendance, and the reason I haven't is because I don't need to. But it occurred to me that even though I know all your names, in fact, the 306 contingent may not know who the 305 contingent is and vice versa. So I will take attendance so that the people in class can learn who the other people are. So I looked at my notes from last year for this week's, and I looked at the notes for Tuesday, and I said, wow, you know, or I'm sorry, last week. I said, wow, you know, there aren't hardly any notes here. And then I noticed that all the notes had to do with syntax. So what I did was I added a bunch of notes about semantics, which actually turns out to be fairly important. And then, as you saw, they disappeared. But it occurred to me as I looked at Thursday's notes, which is what we're going to be talking about today, as you can see, there's a lot of notes here, and we're probably not going to get all the way through it. So my suspicion is what I did was I wrote a very short lecture for Tuesday, and then the intention was I would start Thursday's lecture when I was done with Tuesday's lecture, and we would carry on. But since I didn't write that down anyplace, it was up to me to remember, which, of course, is an immediate loss. So I suspect that's what happened, although I still haven't found my lecture notes on semantics for classes. So I'll have to add those. And maybe we can circle back and talk about those at the other replacement lecture that we're going to have. Today's lecture is a continuation of our discussion on classes, and in particular, we're going to introduce the notion of scope, and then discuss packages and class paths. Finally, because it is in the chapter, I'm also going to talk a little bit about comments in JavaDoc. The lecture on Tuesday's lecture on last Thursday, more or less relied on your experience with other languages that are similar, C++, maybe C#. This lecture, on the other hand, we're going to go wander off into the weeds. There should be things here that are completely unfamiliar to you, at least with respect to your C++ experience, maybe your C# experience. I know of C# the language, but since C# hangs out in a pretty tawdry environment, I don't really know how you use C# in a regular system. I know how to use it in mono, for example, but that's not usually where people use C#. So. Which means that I'm going to move a little bit more slowly, even though we have a lot more things to discuss, to make sure that people understand. Because getting the things that we are talking about today wrong can be extremely painful for various reasons that I'll introduce as we come up with them. And it's very easy to get these things wrong. A lot of the things I'm going to be telling you are little distillations of like 2 or 3 years of trying to figure out why this is not working and finally getting it out. Class paths in particular were a nemesis of mine. And I don't really claim to understand how they work now even, but at least I can sort of wrestle them to a standoff. Let's start at the beginning with what the program structure looks like. What is a Java program? When you say you're running a Java program, what are you doing? And let's start with the source. Java source essentially comprises one or more source files. To a certain extent, source files are less important in Java than they are in other systems for reasons that we'll discuss in a couple of seconds. The source file is just your basic text file. Again, it's no different from anything else. There are some systems like Smalltalk, for example, where you have to do a little work to turn them into text files, and then if you look at them as a text file, you're saying, wow, what is all this junk? That's not the case for Java. Java, again, is like C++ in the sense that your source file is a basic text file, and you can just read it without too much problem. File name should have the .java extension, which is annoying, but there it is. Each source file contains one or more class definitions, the things that we talked about on Tuesday or last Thursday. Also contains other things which we will discuss as we go along in the semester. But for now, essentially, we're just going to be looking at classes. The other things that we add are added more or less the same way as classes are. So if you understand what we're talking about today, you'll be in good shape to understand the things that we introduce down the line. Each class in a source file compiles into a separate .class file. And this is the reason why source files aren't really that important, because essentially what happens is they get immediately broken apart by the compiler and you have all these .class files laying around, and that is in fact what the rest of the system works on, if you remember the diagrams that I drew at the first week of the semester, which I suppose it wouldn't have hurt to repeat here. I guess I can add that. That's what, when you write a Java program, that's what you're doing, is you're writing a bunch of source files which eventually get turned into class files. And that is the way you should think about organizing your programs. Right? Or at least that's one component of the way you should think about organizing your Java programs. Not in terms of source files, which is what you would do more or less when you're dealing with C++. You would think more in terms of the class files that you get. The JVM builds and executes from .class files. And in particular, the .class files are loaded at runtime as they're needed. This is what's known, it's known as a lot of things. I called it lazy link and load. It's also known as dynamic loading and other things. This turns out to be a really powerful and also a really dangerous feature. It allows you to do things at runtime. You can make decisions at runtime. You can make optimizations at runtime. You can do a lot of really interesting things. You can make changes at runtime. Now, of course, you can do this with, if you have a dynamic loader. For example, if you're familiar with the way Unix works, you can do all this stuff. You can grab a hold of the dynamic loader and do these things yourself. But the JVM takes care of all of that stuff for you. It does it automagically. And furthermore, it does it securely in the sense that there are sets of properties that the JVM will verify and guarantee with respect to the files that it's loading, which turns out to be important for the environments in which Java was originally planned to be running. We will not be pursuing any of this in this class, which is unfortunate because, like I said, it is a pretty interesting and pretty powerful thing to do, but we must move on. And also, it's kind of confusing too. There's really strange interactions between the security model and dynamic loading, as you might expect. Well, not necessarily that they are strange interactions, but there would be interactions. It's just they seem strange when you look at them. The process of going from your Java source program to your Java.class files is compilation. The Java C compiler, in addition to taking source and turning it into class files, also deals with class files itself. So even if you're not going to run any of these programs, you still need to understand what's going on with respect to the class files, because the .c compiler is going to be looking for class files to do various things during compilation. It needs them for type checking, for example, one of the things that it does. The compiler manages the .class source file relationship consistency automatically. So for example, if it notices that there's a .class file, but the associated .source file is older than the, no, I'm sorry, got that backwards, is newer than the .class file, then it will compile the .class, the source file into the new .class file. Now, that is interesting. Why? Given the information I've told you now, why is that interesting? Well, what does the compiler do? The compiler takes a source file and turns it into a bunch of class files. All right, so it's looking at a bunch of class files. Then it notices, hey, there's a source file over here that is newer than, for example, this class file over there. What can the compiler conclude? No. How does it know that? What does it have to know in order to make that conclusion? That's true, but it also has to know something else. No, it doesn't really care who updated it. Well, I suppose that would be an interesting thing to have, but in this case, that's not one of the things it has. It has to know that that class file came from the source file. And the question is, how does it know that? The only way it can know that is by looking at the source file and seeing if this particular class is defined in that source file. If it is, it has to do a recompilation. So there's a lot of things going on in background. This also points out why conventions are important, in particular the conventions associated with, as we will see, public methods and public classes. Public classes in particular, but also public methods. For the most part, you don't have to worry about that. Occasionally, it doesn't work. It becomes confused, and I actually really have not figured out why it becomes confused. And your program won't compile. Let's say class file out of date, can't update, or something like that. And when those things happen, like I said, I don't really understand why they occur. So I just delete all the class files and recompile everything. As a practical matter, what this means is you can just sort of issue one compilation on one file, and everything else gets compiled automatically as it's needed. But occasionally that goes wrong. So normally what I do is I just compile everything. I have, Java C star.java, which isn't really necessary. And the Java compiler is smart. It's noticing that if you ask it to compile a source file that generates class files that are newer than the source file, it won't recompile because there's no point. Unless, of course, there is another class or interface that's being used by the source file that has been updated, then it will. So it actually does take care of all of this, but occasionally it does go wrong. That's just a little warning that it's not perfect. What kind of development structure works well with Java? How do you organize your projects, your programs? The trick here is that there are two sets of files to worry about, the source files and the .class files. Oh, and another thing I guess I talk about it here. From a certain point of view, well, that's no different from what you're used to now in C and C++, because you have, in C++, you have your source file, your .cc or whatever, and then that gets compiled into .o files, which are, in a sense, the equivalent to the .class files, in some small sense. So from that point of view, they're the same. On the other hand, they're actually quite different. In particular, the .class files are machine independent. I can compile a .class file, for example, on my old PowerPC Mac, right, and then take that class file and bring it over to my Debian x86 and run it there and use it there. Whereas if I compile something on a PowerPC, I get a .o that is only understandable on the PowerPC, and furthermore, quite likely, depending upon the API, can also be used in a Macintosh operating system as opposed to a, as opposed to a Macintosh operating system running on an x86 system. No, that was actually the wrong direction. As opposed to some other operating system like Debian running on a PowerPC, because they would have different binary APIs into the kernel. That's not the case with respect to the class files. Once you get a class file, you can drag that anywhere you want, and that's sort of that's a heritage of where Java came from. This idea, that you have this myriad of small devices out there that are all networked together, and you just punt code out to them, and they all execute it. One possibility, so what's one possible structure for this? Let's go back to the problem that we're trying to solve here. What's one possible structure for this kind of program? So you need to write a program, which actually will start next week. Next week will be the start of the fourth week, and then you'll get your first assignment.
Write it, compile it, and run it on your own system?
Right, but what structure would you use to do that? What would the directory, let's put it that way, the directory you're working in, what would that look like? Yeah, certainly one possibility is just create a directory called assignment one and put everything in there. And that's what's known as sort of the monolithic structure. Everything's in one place. All the source files, all the class files, everything is right there. And there's some advantages to that, right? You don't have to go too far. It's a very simple structure. You don't lose things, or if you do lose things, they're easy to find because you just do an ls as opposed to having to change directory all over the place and remember where you need to change directory. But there are some problems with monoliths, particularly as you start to write larger and larger programs. Monoliths are not very well structured. Like I said, everything's in one place. They're very simply structured, but apart from that, there's not much differentiation between the things in the monolith. It's all the same. It all looks the same, even though you know that's not the case. That doesn't scale well. And as you go to larger and larger programs, and furthermore, it's hard to deal with. If you're trying to remember where a particular function is and you have everything in one directory, well, you know that everything you have to look at is in this one directory, but unfortunately, there's a lot of stuff in that one directory, so it can be hard to figure out where things are. Again, the way we solve this problem, if you have one big thing that's causing you troubles, is you apply divide and conquer, break it up into interacting pieces. We talked a little bit about this with respect to object-oriented programming, and what we're doing here, in a sense, is backing up a level. We're going to a higher level, trying to figure out what the structure of the system is, as opposed to the structure of our objects should be. One way to break them up is what's known as functional division. And this is sort of a hand-wavy, design-ish kind of a thing, because I'm actually not going, this is not going to be a very important topic of discussion, but I'll just give you something that you can use as an introduction or a guideline to doing this. One way to break up a monolith into pieces is using what's known as functional division. That's usually the best approach to take, but there are other approaches, and I believe there's a link on the lecture notes that will take you to a discussion of functional division. Functional division essentially says, well, you break the monolith up into pieces, and the pieces have the characteristic that everything in that piece has some related structure, has some related function. So everything associated with, so for example, suppose you're implementing a Tetris game, all right, and you look at your Tetris game and you say, well, you know, I have a board and pieces, right, so that's one part of my Tetris game. Another part is you have to actually play the game. You have to have things dropping down, and you have to respond to commands. So that's another part of the game, is the gameplay. And then another part is I have to actually see all this, so I have some interface part. And then there's, I don't know, maybe a fourth part having to do with scorekeeping, or maybe it's a network Tetris game where you can play against somebody else. If you have a monolith, then everything, all that is in one big directory. The alternative is to do a functional division where you say, okay, this directory contains the code that's responsible for the board and the pieces. So all the code in this directory defines the board and the pieces. Then you have another directory that does, what did I say, gameplay, responsible for dropping the pieces and all that, and enforcing the rules of whatever they may be for Tetris. And then a third directory would have all the code associated with the display of the game, so forth and so on, the user interface part. And essentially what you're doing is you're producing a set of mini monoliths. Rather than having one big monolith, you have a bunch of small mini monoliths. Okay, so there's our subdivision into smaller problems. Now, it may very well be that those mini monoliths are still too big. For example, my suspicion is the graphics mini monolith is still going to be huge. Though you probably might want to break that up again into output display and interactive input, or however you want to do it. So you'd have two micro monoliths under the GUI mini monolith. The advantage here, though, is that in your subproblems, each new monolith is smaller than the original. Therefore, it's in some sense easier to deal with, if not necessarily easy to deal with. And it's functionally consistent, so it's not much effort to wrap your head around it, because you're not wrapping your head around an entire system. You're just wrapping it around a little piece. This is an art as opposed to a science, which is another reason why I'm not going to go into it in any great detail. But again, I mentioned it for two reasons. One, it's one of the ways you might think about doing things, but it's also an echo of the way you do object-oriented design. Right? Except this case, we're going from specifics to generalizations as opposed to object-oriented design, which goes the other way. Okay. What does that have to do with Java? What it has to do with Java is we can think about those monoliths in terms of what's known as a package. So a package is essentially a named group of class files. In a sense, it represents when I said monolith on the previous slide, I could replace that now with package. And notice what we're doing is we're sort of pushing the source files away. I indicated earlier that source files really weren't that important. And now, I'm sort of emphasizing that by saying that we're going to be talking about packages, and packages are all about class files, nothing else. So a package is a named group of class files. Every class file is a member of exactly one package. Right? This is something that you should internalize when you deal with Java and you deal with class files, that whatever class file you have is always in some package. This is always going to be true, particularly when we start talking about jar files, which don't look at all like what we're talking about today. It's in a package, though. That's the point. A source file declares package membership with a package statement. This is how you figure out where packages belong. Notice that this is independent of location. Right? Package statements are really simple. You have the package command, if you want, or sudo command, and then the actual name of the package. Every class file created from that source file will go into the declared package. Now, that actually doesn't quite mean what you think it means, as I'll explain. And this represents our first, could possibly represent our first source of pain, as I'll explain later. All right? Questions about that? Again, every class file generated is in some package, and the package statement in the associated source file answers the question, what package is it? It's whatever you say. And notice I haven't told you what package name is. We'll talk about that in a little while. All right, so it's 25 of, or I should say probably 235. So like I said, school's closed. If you want to leave, go right ahead. Actually, I wonder if we get in trouble. I wonder if the cops will throw us out. Well, we'll find out. Okay, so what? Given a class reference via its name, for example, Tetris board, give me a Tetris board named board, both the compiler and the JVM need to figure out where that class file is, because the compiler, for example, needs to access Tetris board to figure out, okay, what can I do on that thing? What kind of methods can I call on it? Because it's going to be compiling code, presumably, that uses board, so there are going to be method calls on board, and the question is this a legal method call? The compiler has to be able to answer that, and the way that it answers that is it looks for the class file to get that information out. And of course, obviously the JVM needs it because it's saying, I got to create a Tetris board. In this case, I don't do it here, but presumably I do it someplace later. I need to know how to do that, so it needs to know the class file. So in both cases, the compiler and the JVM need access to the class file. Well, certainly one way you can do it is it can just say, great, I'll just look in all the packages I know about and look for the class file. Well, first of all, the first problem with that could be expensive because you can have a huge number of class files, and you do. You do, as we'll see. I'll show you how you can figure out how many class files you're dealing with. Which means that this would now be expensive. Now, but of course you can say, oh, well, you know, we know about databases. We can do indexing, and that's true, you can. But again, there are stable classes, sets of stable classes, and then less stable classes. So that in some cases is a good answer, but it's not a universal answer. An even more difficult question to deal with is you can have several classes with the same name in different packages. I actually haven't given you enough information to justify this, but as you might expect, it's true, and I'll tell you why in a couple of slides. So just treating the entire set of packages as one big package isn't really going to be either possible in the case of multiple class names or particularly convenient in the case of very large packages. We need to do something else. And of course, what we need to do is tell the compiler, where is this class? All right, every class has a package. So when I say Tetris board, in addition to just saying Tetris board, I need to tell the compiler in that package. So now the compiler doesn't have to search. In a sense, we're going to the opposite extreme. Rather than have the compiler search every possible package, we're going to tell the compiler to go directly to the package we mean, which is sensible if you think about it, particularly under the possibility of having several different versions of the same class file. So you tell the compiler and the JVM via the compiler the package that holds the class. And you do that with what's known as package qualification, which indicates the membership of the class file in the package. That looks like the standard kind of access you've seen before. You have the package name, which again is similar to the package name we've seen on the package statement, with a dot and then the class name. So in the case of our Tetris board example on the previous slide, I'm saying that Tetris board in the package board, then I want a board. Almost every class reference has to be package qualified. Almost every class reference you make has to be package qualified. Now, you should be able to come up with one counterexample to that. I don't know. I'll assume that you've seen Java code in which the class name isn't package qualified. So the question is, why is that? Well, first of all, who can give me an example of of code they've seen in which the class name was not package qualified?
Main.java?
Sorry?
Main?
That is not a class name. That is a method. I don't know, do I have any? Let's see. Did I bring my lecture notes with me? No, I didn't.
If it's in the same package?
No. Well, yeah, that's true. But since we don't know what packages are, that's string. If you've ever seen a Java program that uses string, right, how do you declare a string in Java? You say string S. Well, what package is string in? Right? Because you didn't say something.string, you just said string. And it turns out that string is in the java.lang package. Okay. And the compiler will automatically look in java.lang for classes that it can't find otherwise. So you don't have to tell the compiler if something is in java.lang. It will find it automatically. Now, you can if you want. You can say java.lang.string, but you don't have to. So that's why I have here almost. If you're not dealing with something that the compiler understands, then you need to actually use the package qualification. Questions about that? So every class is in a package, and furthermore, every class name reference has to be qualified by the package in which it is stored. Can a class access any other class in any other package? That's the question we want to ask now. So we've divided things up, right? And now the question is, how do we put things back together? That's the way it usually works. You divide things up, but you really want to have them all work together. So how can we do that? And that's the question we're going to answer now. One of the techniques or methods that we're going to, I guess I shouldn't use methods since that's an overloaded term here. One of the techniques that we're going to use to answer that is the idea of scope. Scope refers to the extent over which a feature exists and can be accessed. Okay, I assume that you're all familiar again with scope from your C and C++, or in fact any, it's hard to think of a scopeless programming language. There are a few. I can't think of one right offhand, except possibly for assembly language, things like that, although you could still argue that segments are, in a sense, a scope. A feature that exists and is accessible, both of those things have to be true, it has to exist and it has to be accessible, is in what's known as in scope. If you have a non-existent feature, a feature that doesn't exist, or it does exist but you can't get at it, that's what's known as being out of scope. So another way to ask this question is, given a class in a particular package, what else is in scope for that class? In other words, what else exists and can be accessed by that class? So that's another way to ask that question. What scopes have we seen so far? I have not actually explicitly identified them, so let's do that now. We have seen packages, although I haven't explicitly justified that as a scope. We will do that in a couple of minutes. And, of course, we have classes, which are the traditional units of scope. Methods, again, another traditional unit of scope, are the three scopes that we've seen so far. Okay, there are lots of other ones. When we get to the statements, of course, each statement will have individual scope, potentially have individual scopes. For example, compound statements have their own scope. There are other scopes that we'll be talking about in later lectures during the semester. The features introduced so far are packages, classes, methods, and field variables. Okay. Now, I'm using a term here. In fact, that's another thing I should warn you about. I'm going to be using non-standard terms here because I find them to be more descriptive and more convenient to remember than the terms that are supposed to be used. So I will point out when these occur, and this is the first one that's occurred. Field variables, essentially, as we will see in a minute, are essentially instance variables and what are known as class variables, or what I'm going to redefine as, I'm sorry, what are known as static variables, what I'm going to redefine as a class variable. So when I say a field variable, this is either an instance or a class variable. Okay, and at this point, I don't need to distinguish between the two, so that's why I just call them a field variable. I suppose you could argue that this is a redundancy, right? Since if it's a variable in a class, it's automatically a field. But I just didn't want to say variable because it wouldn't be clear whether we were talking about a variable in a method or a variable in a parameter list or a variable in a class. So I say field variable to make it clear that I'm talking about something that's declared in a class. And there will be others that we'll talk about in later lectures. So these are the scopes. These are the things that can be accessed within a scope or not, depending upon whether it's in scope or out of scope. Questions? All right, so what's the general question? I gave you sort of a specific example of the question a couple slides ago. Let's go and determine what the general question is. Can feature X in scope Y be accessed from scope Z? That's the question we need to ask. And notice that requires us to understand three things. The thing that we are trying to access, the scope within which that thing exists and is accessible, and the scope from which I'm trying to do the access. So those are the three things that we have to keep in mind or know about when we want to answer this question. We can turn that around, and this is actually important for building systems in the large, and this is one of the places where Java falls down. We can turn that around and say, how can scope Z be prohibited from accessing feature X in scope Y? This is the issue of making sure that you have minimal coupling between your modules, where we just assume an arbitrary or generic interpretation of the term module. We would like to minimize the coupling, either intentional or accidental. And we do that by not only allowing things to occur, but also prohibiting other accesses to occur. The combinatorics of these questions are complex. If you notice now, I've introduced three scopes and four different things that we can access in those scopes, and now I've introduced three different variables that make up the question of access. And so you've got 3 × 4 × 4, and like I said, this isn't all we're talking about. We're going to be adding scopes, and we're going to be adding things that you can access within scopes. So the combinatorics of this question becomes really complex, particularly since we are actually not considering all the issues associated with scope and access either, which essentially means that you really should take small steps, and don't be afraid to count on your fingers, because I still am whenever I have to deal with access questions with respect to Java. I still have to stop and more or less draw pictures or do other kinds of things that are equivalent of counting on your fingers to make sure that you get the right answer and to make sure that you understand the answer that you get, because there could, in fact, be hidden consequences to an answer that looks like it's reasonable but, in fact, turns out to be drastically wrong in some property that it has that you didn't recognize. Package, scope, and classes. And now we can start to introduce this package scope. Again, method scope you're assumed familiar with from your C++ experience. Class scope, again, you're assumed familiar with from your C++ experience. The things that are different between C++ and Java with respect to class scope, we will talk about later on in the semester. For purposes of this lecture, they're essentially the same, which leaves package scope, this strange scope that we've been discussing with respect to class files. By default, each class in package X can access any class in package X. And I see that I was perhaps a little too specific here. I should actually say access any entity in package X, where entity could be class or method or instance variable. And you can access it by using just the class name. This was Jansen's observation about not needing to have a package qualifier in front of a class name. If one class is referring to a class in the same package, then you don't need a qualifier there. That's another example of where you wouldn't need a qualifier. Although you could add it, and generally speaking, unless you're dealing with very small packages, which in one sense you probably should be, I would argue that you should add the package qualification even though you don't need it. The compiler defaults to searching the containing package for the other classes. So the package in which the class is defined, sorry, I didn't say that right, the compiler will search the package in which the referencing class is defined for the referenced class. And here I'll just say class as opposed to saying class or method or variable, okay? But remember that those are the other things that we could potentially want to access. The other form of that question, if you remember, was preventing access. And so by default, classes that are not in package X cannot access any class in package X. So any class that's outside of package X cannot, by default, access things in package X, class, method, variable. And now that provides pressure for doing a monolithic package, because if you put everything in one package, then everything has access to everything else. You don't have to worry about this. Right? Naturally, as you might expect, that's not very good design, although it is convenient because now you can get rid of package qualifications. This set of scope access rules is known as the default package scope. If you don't do anything, you get the default package scope. Questions about that? Now here's an example. If I'm in some directory and I do an ls, I get two directories called A and B. If I list directory A, I have a file called c1.java. If I list directory B, there's a file called c2.java. It looks like this. I take a look at c1.java, which is in directory A, and I see that the first statement is package A. This says that any class file you create in the process of compiling this source file is to be placed in package A. And, of course, C1 doesn't do anything. It's a very simple class. Then I take a look at C2 in directory B. It declares that any class created in the compilation of this file will go in package B. And there are two classes, C2, which doesn't do anything, and then C3, which references C2 once, C2 twice, and then C1 once. Okay, notice that in this case, we have a class qualification, sorry, package qualification here. I'm saying class C2 in package B. Here I'm just saying C2, and that's okay, because C2 is in package B, as is C3. So they are both in the same package. They can both access their features without any need for qualification. On the other hand, C1 is in a different package, which means that if I leave off the qualification, the compiler is going to look in package B. It's not going to find anything. You're going to get an error message here. So I need to put the qualification in and say package A. Look there. This is the picture after compilation. The picture would look like this. I'd have a class file C1 in package A, and then two class files, C2 and C3, in package B. Okay?
So on that second line under B.C2, you also have B.C2 would be correct. Mutation.
Yes, that would be correct. And also I could take away that too. Either way, for something as simple as this, of course, you really don't need the qualification. But generally, I would argue that this is better than this because it tells you package B. Because even though the compiler can figure it out, the people who are reading your code also need to be able to figure it out. And they're not compilers, so you've got to make it easy for them. All right, well, that looks great, sort of. So let's compile, and we compile things and get an error. Okay, so where did this error come from? Why did I get this error? Yes?
You didn't give it access to anything outside of
package. Okay. So we are falling afoul of this rule. By default, classes that are not in package X cannot access any class in package X. All right, C3 is not in package A. It's in package B. So it has no access to package A. If you don't do anything, if you just do this, you don't have access. The problem we're having is this link here from package B, from C3 in package B to C1 in package A. That is not allowed by default. So what do we do? How do we fix that? We want to be able to do this. It doesn't make much sense to break things up into packages and then say, oh, you can only access things within your same package, because then you're back to the monolith. So we actually need to loosen this up. So let's press ahead. So we're going to introduce, so that scope, the default package scope, is probably too strong for us. It may be convenient on occasion, but if you're writing large systems, you're going to need to use other scopes. So let's introduce a new scope. And in fact, the scope that we're going to introduce sort of indicated to you in the error message, it's not public in A. So that means that you can't access it. So apparently we have to introduce this new scope. Default package scope is too restrictive because, again, breaking things up into small pieces is good, but if you're going to break things up into small pieces, you need to allow cross-package access or inter-package access, as opposed to intra-package access, which is automatic. The public scope for a class, or just the public class, allows access to the class from any package. So we can provide that cross-package, cross-package linkage by declaring the entity we are attempting to access to be public. Public entities can then be accessed from outside the class. We indicate a public class with the public keyword. If you remember the syntax of classes I talked about on Tuesday, which was last Thursday, I said that the class and the methods start with this modifier, and in the case of methods, it had the return type and so forth. But I didn't give you any modifiers. Well, I've just given you the first modifier, public. We can have a public method. We can have a public class. We can also have a public variables, field variables. Public scope is a per-class scope, not per-package. So if I declare a particular class within a scope to be public that says nothing about the other classes in that package. And so each declaration you place, each scope declaration you place, public being the first one that we've talked about, applies only to the entity to which you are applying it. This is particularly true, and this confused me a little bit the first time I fooled around with it. If you declare a method to be public, that does not declare the class containing that method to be public, too. And you might want to think about, well, what good is that then? But the point here is that public scope does not migrate to other containing entities. Right, so if I declare a class public, that says nothing about the other classes in the source file, for example. If I declare a method public, it doesn't say anything about the other methods in that class or the class itself. Same thing with instance variables. It applies entirely to the entity that's being declared public. All right, so I have these public classes. What do? The name of a source file containing a public class must be the same as the public class name. This is our first convention that you have to follow. Right. I've introduced several Java conventions that you can ignore, like camel case and uppercase characters on class names and things like that. This one you can't ignore, because if you do, the compiler will just get all confused. And, of course, the reason it's, well, let me just go through it. So here is a file called T. It contains a public class called capital T. So notice that, at least in Unix anyway, these are two different names. Java is case sensitive, so these are in fact two different names. If I try and compile this, I'll get an error message that says the class T is public and it should be declared in a file named t.java. So in other words, the name of the file should match the name of the class, the public class declared within that file. And it gives me an error. And so this is the one place where you really should obey that convention of naming. And, of course, what that means is you just turn right around and conclude that, well, you can only have one public class per source file, right? Because if you have two public classes in the same file, well, they have to have different names, otherwise you're going to get a compilation error there. And if they have different names, then what are you going to call a source file? It can only have one name, so it's got to be called either public class 1 or public class 2. And when you try and compile that, the other public class is going to cause this error message. So you can only have one public class in a file. You can have as many non-public classes as you want, though. That's fine. Now, why is that? What's that rule for? Actually, that's probably a tricky question. I'll let you think about that. That's probably a tricky question. So you can just write that down if you're interested. We'll go on from. Go ahead. Well, you can. You can have them in different packages. In fact, you can have them in the same package for reasons that we'll discuss later on. But
if the name of the class has to match the name of the source file?
The name of the public class has to match the name of the source file.
You can't have two public classes in the same source file because they can't be the same.
Exactly. Right. But the question is, why do let's suppose I only have one. Why does the name of the source file have to be the same as the name of the public class? And this only applies to classes, too, not to methods or instance variables or field variables. Well, I'll let you think about that, because I don't know that we've talked about everything you need to know to be able to answer that question. So here's an example of public scope. I thought I put more space between those. So again, here's A and B, directories A and B. I list A and it contains C1. I list B and it contains C2. Oh, okay, so now what we're doing is we're going back and we're fixing my previous error. So we're going back and fixing this problem. Right? We had this problem where class C3 wanted to access class C1. Right? So that's the problem we introduced, and the solution that we introduced to solve that problem is the idea of a public scope. So now we're going to fix it. And the way that we're going to fix that is we're going to declare C1 to have public scope. We add the public keyword before the class to indicate that this class should be accessible everywhere, inside and outside the package. We don't have to make any changes here. This is the same. The only change we make is this keyword. Okay, and compilation will give us this. Now we actually run the compiler on C2. It goes A.C1. The compiler says, oh, I know where that is. And what's more, I know how to get to it. I know I'm allowed to access it. So the compilation goes through. Everybody's happy. This link is perfectly okay now. The link between C3 and C1. Questions about that? A class has either public or package scope. In other words, you only have access to a feature within the class, or everybody has access to that feature. There is no restrictions. I can't say, well, everybody in package A can access C1, and only the classes in package B. So in other words, if I had another package C, it could not access C1.class. I can't say that in Java, which is something you really like to be able to say if you're going to write large systems. And this is an example of where Java's heritage is something that you anticipated running in small set-top boxes begins to show through. And because you have small set-top boxes, you don't have a lot of memory to play with. You have 32, 64, maybe a meg. And so you don't have a lot of space to write a lot of code, particularly if it's interpreted code. And the idea that you would build tens or hundreds of million line systems didn't really apply. So the kinds of structuring techniques that you'd like to use to build those large systems weren't really relevant to what Java was originally intended for. Now, unfortunately, people are building 10 and 100 million line Java programs, and they're using a scope mechanism which was designed for a far smaller, much more restricted environment. Oh, well. Although I should point out that there are people who are working to make Java be more friendly towards large system development. I believe they are implementing some sort of module system in Java, and I'm not sure whether that will be in the next version of Java, which I guess is Java 7 or not. There is actually, you can follow it, you go to the Java community process website, and they have descriptions of the new features that will be in Java 7. One of them will be this module system. But for our purposes, since we're not going to be dealing with Java 7, a class either has all or nothing scope is one way to think about it. Package scope is global within the package itself. This is another problem. You can have a similar problem within the package itself. There may very well be that you only want to have some small subset of the classes in package A access each other's features, and none of the other classes in package A should be able to get at those features. You can't do that. The only way you can do that is to peel off that small subset as a separate package. Okay, but then you're stuck, right? Because presumably there's going to be some form of interaction here. Otherwise, you probably need to refactor your packages, the way you structure things in packages. But if you move this subset into a different package, now you've got the scope problem, right? Because by default, package A prime, classes in package A prime, or I should say packages in what's left of A, can access, by default, the classes in package A prime. But you want to allow that access, so what do you have to do? You have to make the classes in package A prime be public. And now you're back to what you had before. Everything can access everything else. So it's really hard to write nicely structured, larger, actually not even larger. I've run into this problem like last year when I was writing the code for the assignments. I really wanted to have nice little, because I'm really anal like that. I like to have nice small packages that are tight and have minimal interfaces. But that's really hard to do in Java because of this all or nothing scope that we have. Right, so that was this point. Package scope is global within the package. So everything has access to everything else within the package. So you've got to make sure that they're all very friendly. So this is like super friends, if you want, in C++. Although it's not quite as bad as friends. Every class in the package can access every other class in the package. Problems with this suggest that you have design errors. And if you have difficulties, or if it's not a really good way to approach your design, then perhaps you need to rework the design. Okay, and in particular, the package itself may be too big, but then you run into the splitting problem that I just talked about. If you split things, you still need to have this inter-package access, and that, if you're not very careful, can reopen the problem that you're trying to run away from. So it's really annoying to try and design well-structured big systems in Java, which we're not going to do in this class, but still. Okay, any questions about that? All right, so let's talk about the default package. Well, when you've written Java programs, how many people have declared packages when they've written Java programs? How many people have used a package statement when they wrote Java programs? Well, I guess you did too, right? Or who wrote Java?
Yeah, I never used a
package. Right, so you never use a package. So I've said every class file that's generated is in a package. But if you haven't written a package statement, what are the class files that get generated from your code? Where do they go? What package are they in? Right? And for those of you that haven't written Java, if you think back to the email you may have gotten over the weekend about, what was it about? Anyway, it had the factorial program. Oh, it was about watching the JIT compilations. If you look at that program that I included in that message, that didn't have a package declaration either. So if you compile that program, what package is fact in? The fact class. What package is that in? I said every class is in a package, but I didn't say in the source file what the package was. So now the question is, what package is it in? And the answer, of course, is it's in the default package. If you don't say, it's in the default. Every class file is a member of some package, like I said, but if we have a class file or if we have a source file that doesn't have a package declaration, what package is C1 in, or what package is fact in? Classes that are not explicitly placed in a package fall into the nameless default package, which is why you actually didn't have to do anything to reference fact as a class. You didn't have to have any package qualifier in front of it. You just could say fact. And the reason you could do that is because the default package is nameless. So if you think about it, you can think about it as nothing.fact or nothing.C1. But then, of course, if you did that, you'd write code that looks like Bliss, and, well, we don't want to do that. So, I mentioned that you have to tell the compiler, whenever you reference a class by name, you also have to tell the compiler using package qualification where that class is within a package. Every non-local class access has to be package qualified, which can be a pain. You have to write lang, you know, assuming if we ignore for the moment the fact that the compiler knows where to look, if every time you had to write string, you actually had to write java.lang.string, that would be a pain in the neck. So we need some way to indicate once and for all, yes, I'm talking about Tetris board, and it's the Tetris board in the board package, so that anytime I use Tetris board, I don't have to say board.tetrisboard. I could just say board. The statement that lets you do that is what's known as the import statement. The import statement explicitly locates a class for the compiler. By the time the compiler gets done with it, the information gets passed on in a more sanitized form to the JVM. That looks like this. You have the import keyword followed by a package qualified class. Right, so this differs from the package statement in the sense that the package statement was followed by a package qualifier, but there was no class associated with it. Here you have a package qualified class. This is going to be important when we deal with templates, because one of the things that I always forget is, oh, I need to import the list generic template. What do I call it? Do I say list angle bracket, or do I leave the angle brackets off? And we'll answer that question eventually, but not now. Imported classes then don't need a package qualification. Right. Unless you're dealing with identically named classes from different packages, then you still need to explicitly qualify to indicate which one you're referring to. To go back to our previous example, and I started a sentence with so again, to go back to the previous example, in c2.java, I access c1. I had that explicitly qualified a.c1. I can get rid of that explicit qualification, which would be stupid in this case since I only have two characters here, as opposed to import A.C1. Now, any reference to C1 by the compiler will automatically be interpreted relative to the A package. I can run this through the compiler, and again, no error. So the links are, the link between packages is fine because C1 is still public. And I've removed the need to package qualify C1 now because I've done it in an import statement. Questions about that? This is similar to namespace in C++, right? Namespace and using. So again, your previous experience with respect to C++ should help you here. At least a little bit, anyway. We can also do that was a class by class import. Okay, we can also do what's known as a global import. We can just essentially say import from package qualified or package quantification dot star. Import everything you can. In other words, all the public stuff. Assuming you're in a different package. If you're in the same package, of course, you don't need to do this because, in a sense, the compiler does it implicitly for you. And this will import every public class from the given package. This is what most people do. If you look at most people's Java code, they'll say, you know, import java.util.star. My recommendation is you don't do that. My recommendation is you explicitly import every class that you use. And the reason for that, it's documentation. It tells you when you see something called, I don't know, let's see if I can think. If you see something, we'll see an example, a certificate, right? I see the certificate class. Well, where did that come from? What package is that in? Well, if I go up to the top and I see all these things that say import package star, I don't know. But if I say import Java security cert certificate, now I know what the package is. And I can now look it up and so forth and so on. On the other hand, if you have a really good IDE, it doesn't matter because the IDE will scurry around and figure it out for you. On the other hand, some people don't have a good IDE or some people are reading from a piece of paper. So, in addition, if you do indiscriminate star imports, particularly if you're dealing with third-party packages, you could have unnecessary name clashes. You could have company A's package, you open that up with a star, and you have company B's package, you open that up with a star, and then they both have the classes with the same name. Now you have name clashes, and now you have to go back to explicitly disambiguating those by using package qualification. So it'd be nice to document that, right? To indicate, in fact, that you've got a widget class in company A and a widget class in company B. And you can do that explicitly by using an import statement like that, as opposed to just saying, well, we woofed everything in. All right, any questions about that? Okay, so we've been talking about packages. I've been talking about them abstractly. They're a collection of compilation units, class files. What are they in the real world? What are packages when you're compiling code? Right? What is that? How do you actually represent a package on the system that you're developing on? Well, if you think about it, a package maps pretty naturally into a directory in your file system, assuming you're using a modern file system that's hierarchical, right? If you're using a flat file system, which we're actually going to do when we get the jar files, you can think of that essentially as a flat file system. When we get to, well, never mind, when we get to jar files, we'll see an alternative file system. But for now, we're dealing with modern file systems that are hierarchical. So the mapping between packages and directories is pretty natural. So the idea of, and there's another so, the idea of mapping packages into file systems is a pretty natural one. In fact, it's the one that gets used. On the other hand, as I just pointed out, it's not required. You can use other mappings if you want. You just have to make sure you define them. Under a system like this, then what would happen is the package Tetris would map into the directory called Tetris. And of course, we have to be a little careful here because you may have case issues between systems that are case sensitive, like Unixes, and then that are not case sensitive, like Windows. And again, this mapping is the most natural one. It's the one that seems to fit. By most natural, I mean goes through with the least amount of work. But it's not required. You could do something else if you wanted to. Now we'll issue the warning. This is the first place where we're going to enter really swampy ground. As the general semanticists point out, the map is not the territory. And what I mean by that is, do not confuse directories and packages. This is a source of tremendous confusion. It was for me, and I imagine it would be for most of you, even though that assumes that you're as dumb as I am. They are different things. They are related through this idea of the mapping between package names and directory names, but they are different things, and forgetting that can cause a tremendous amount of confusion. In particular, not every class in a directory is part of the same package. So that's the first thing, is to say, okay, I have a directory, so that's a package. No, that's not necessarily the case. You could have more than one package in the same directory. And I'll have an example of that in a couple of slides. So there's one example of where the mapping, while it still applies, actually goes further than what the directory structure is in the system. So if you use your directory structure as a representation of the package structure, you're going to be in trouble because the package structure is richer than the directory structure. Another problem, and this one can really get you. Another problem is Java does not check to see that a source file in a package is being compiled in the proper directory for the package. Let's see if I have an example of what that means. Okay, so let me just go on and we'll come back to this because this is important. I make this mistake usually on every Java program I write. I'll have a source file in the wrong package. And the compiler is not going to catch that for you. The compiler is just going to go, oh, okay. And then your class files are gone. They are unfindable. And it's a real pain trying to figure out why your program won't run. So let's walk through an example. Again, I list A, and I see that I have two source files, C1 and C2. So that looks like this. I take a look at C1, and I see it's declared in package A. Great. Doesn't do anything. I take a look at C2, and it's class C2, but there's no package. It's in the default package, right? The one that we had talked about earlier. If you don't explicitly put it in a package, it falls into the default package. I compile both of those. Right? I now have two packages in directory A. I have package A here, and I have the default package. So here's an example where I have two packages in the same directory. So the package structure is richer than the directory structure. Notice that this is not the same thing, as we will see in a couple of slides, as having a subdirectory in A. That's a different issue. Questions about that? Again, you need to understand this. You make sure you understand what this is saying to you. Let's see, what do we have next? All right, so let's do a compilation. I compile C2, which is this, and notice that C2 has a reference to C1. What's the assumption here?
That's in the same directory.
Exactly. That's exactly the assumption, which is incorrect. That's why you have to distinguish between directories and packages. That's exactly the mistake you'll make. And we see it here. Compile C2, it says to the compiler, oh, I'm going to be accessing C1, so you better figure out all the nifty things you need to know about C1. And the compiler says, oh, I don't know where that is. It's certainly not in the default package, because that's the package that you're in. And since I have no class qualification, you're obviously accessing a class in the same package that you're in, which is the default package. Boom. Even though they share the same directory, the packages are separate. That's exactly the point you need to take away. And that's it. I mean, once you have your head wrapped around this, then you've got it. The only thing you've got to do is you've got to remember to keep that in mind, and then you've got to recognize when it's happening to you. Those are two little difficult things. But once you understand this, then you're fine. Oh, and what was I talking about? I guess I should have an example of what I was talking about before, huh? All right, so let's go back to this example. Java C does not check to see that the source file in a package is being compiled in the proper directory for the package. So let's go here. Wait a minute, I'm going backwards. Let's go here, and let me change this let me change this to be package B. All right, now, c1.java is still in directory A, and directory A maps, as I've indicated, to package A. But the package declaration in c1.java says package B. So C1 is being compiled as if it were in package B. But in fact, the source file is in directory A and therefore maps to package A. This will compile perfectly fine. No error messages, no nothing. You will not get any warnings whatsoever. All right. You can now no longer access C1. Okay, because you're going to say, I want C1 in package B. So you're going to say B.C1. Okay, the compiler is going to say, great, let me look around for package B. And we actually haven't talked about how the compiler does that, but essentially what it's going to do is, all right, by saying, let me look for package B, it's saying, let me look for directory B. And it's not going to find it because we only have A here. So that's what I mean by the class files are lost. Right? They're right there, but the compiler and the JVM, for that matter, is going to say, all right, give me directory B. Where is it? Never going to look in directory A, package A, for that file. So that's what you have to be careful of. And I do this all the time, not necessarily because I'm dumb, which is true, but because I create a structure for my program, and I say, oh, I don't like this structure. Let me cut this package in half and then combine these two packages. And then, of course, I forget to change the package declarations. Or I don't change all the package declarations. Or I change the package declarations wrong. And all of a sudden, I have lost class files. So now I've got to figure out where I made the screw up. You have to be on your toes. And IDEs, to a certain extent, will help you. I'll have a little rant on IDEs when we're done with this. But to a certain extent, they'll help you do this. But you need to be careful when you play around like that. All right, so let's go on and talk about hierarchical packages. I said that there's a mapping between file systems and packages. Well, file systems are hierarchical, so you would kind of think that, well, maybe packages are hierarchical too, and that turns out to be the case. Packages can nest to form a tree structure. Okay, package levels are, again, separated by a dot. So now I can actually give you the syntax of a package quantification. If you remember when I gave you the package statement, I said it was package keyword and package qualification, but I didn't tell you what a package qualification was. Now we can talk about what that is. And it's a sequence of names separated by dots. So I can talk about the package Tetris. Right. But I can also talk about the package Tetris Player Computer. Package hierarchies, again, map naturally into file system hierarchies. In the same way that package A maps into directory A, package Tetris Player Computer maps Tetris into the Tetris directory, player into the subdirectory called player under the Tetris directory, and again, computer into the subdirectory computer under player under Tetris. Again, it doesn't have to be that way. You can implement arbitrary mappings, but this is the most natural one. And that's what I say here. On a Unixoid system, it would Tetris player computer corresponds to Tetris slash player slash computer. And if it was Microsoft, it would be backslashes. One thing, and this took me a while to twig to also, one thing you have to keep straight is that import statements deal with class files only. They do not deal with nested packages. All right, so if I say something like import a.star, this is another reason why stars are a little tricky, because they may give you a incorrect mental model of the way that importation works. If I say import a.star, what does that suggest to you, given this structure? And sort of from your Unixoid experience.
A.b.
Right, everything. It's like, give me, that's what star means. Star is the clean enclosure. Give me everything. And that turns out to be wrong, because import statements deal only with classes. So what a.star actually says is give me everything, where everything means all classes in package A. It just completely ignores the fact that there are some directories in here that go on further down. Okay, so A dot star does not import anything from here or anything from there. If I want these things down here, I have to explicitly say import A dot C dot star. And that says give me all the classes that are in here. If there's subdirectories under here, I don't know about them. I have to explicitly whistle them in. Again, we are not going to, I don't know, I guess it's up to you in your code. We are actually not going to do too much of this. But when you get to real life systems, they do a lot of this. So you need to keep that in mind, that imports deal only with classes, not with the other files that may be in the directory associated with the class. Sorry, package, my mistake. Questions? I still don't have an answer to the question, where are the packages, right? I said, oh, great, we can map them. We can map the Tetris package onto the Tetris directory. But what's your next question if you're the compiler? Right, where's the Tetris directory? So we still need to know where the packages are. I've told you how to map them into directories, but I haven't told you where the directories are, and that's the last piece of the puzzle. Knowing that package X is in directory X isn't really that helpful, because we don't know where directory X is, or the directory X can be a lot of different places, and we need to pick one. The mechanism by which you do that, you make that knowledge available, is known as the class path, the evil, evil class path. Describes locations where package directories may be found. Okay, it essentially what the class path is it's a listing of parent directories that may contain package directories. So if you are familiar with the idea of a load path in C++, if you're familiar with the idea of a load path in Unixoid systems, if you're familiar with the idea of a path in Unixoid and I guess Windows or Microsoft systems, I guess I shouldn't say Windows anymore, right? That's like dead. It's been dead for 5 or 10 years now. I still like saying Windows because it irritates people who deserve to be irritated. Well, I guess they're irritated constantly, so it's a natural state for them. I assume there are similar behaviors in or facilities in Microsoft systems. And of course, since I've drawn the analogy between class paths and paths in Unix, I have also indicated that kinds of problems that can occur with class paths. They're essentially the same kinds of problems that you get with the load library paths and the bin paths, or the bin path in Unix. We can indicate a class path in two ways. The first way is using the class path option. Java C and Java both have the class path command line option. You can also use CP in Java as an abbreviation, and you can use that to set the class path. The default class path is the current directory. So again, if you don't specify a class path at all, then you just look in the current directory. Java C always looks in dot, always. Java, however, only does so by default. This can confuse you, because essentially what this means is you, in a sense, have two different class paths now. You have one for Java, and you have one for Java C. And you would like them to be the same, but unfortunately the compiler and the JVM don't treat them the same, which means you've got to be careful about that. The class path itself is a colon-separated list of directories. This is on Unix. I don't know what it is on Windows systems, because the class path is, in a sense, an extra system or extra JDK facility. It's a host system facility. So the mechanism that you use depends upon whatever the conventions are in your local system. And you should check your local system to see. I would anticipate that they would be consistent with other facilities of this kind, like load library paths and bin paths. But who knows? So here is an example. Again, I'm in some directory that has two subdirectories, A and B. In the A directory, I have a file called ca.java, which declares a class called ca in the package ca. And if I go down into the B directory and take a look at what I have there, I have cb.java, which contains class cb. which accesses A.ca. All right? Now, does this look okay? Anybody see anything that might be a problem?
It's not specifying the package CA.
It being?
The class CB.
Right, CB is not specifying where CA is. Well, it is, actually. It's saying it's in package A.
But it's really only in directory A, not package. It's...
Oh, wait a minute. You're right, that's wrong. That should say CA. That's an error. Oops. I have to fix that. That's wrong. This should say CA.CA. Mm-hmm. Or, alternatively, no, this should say A. Yeah, this is wrong. This should say capital A. My mistake. Yeah, okay. So this should say capital A. Unfortunately, I didn't bring my lecture notes. So. But yeah, but that's wrong. This should say capital A. Now, under that proviso, what? Oh, does that mean they closed the library? Oh, damn it. Oh, well, anyway. Well, this looks all right, right? I'm accessing the class CA in package A, so I've told the compiler it's in package A. Package A, assuming we fix this, this is public, so it's accessible from outside the class. This is outside the class. It's in the default package. So this all looks okay. This all looks like it should compile, again, apart from the CA problem. But there is one small trick, and that's this, which is actually has nothing to do with Java. Let's compile it. So I want to run Java C on cb.java, and bang, class package A does not exist. Can't find it. Like what? Why not? Why doesn't package A exist? What's the problem here?
You're in directory B.
Exactly. The problem here is I'm in directory B. I did this CD. Remember, the default class path is dot. So if I am in directory B and I run the compiler, then the default class path is going to point to directory B. Naturally, it's not going to find any directory called A because there is none. What should I have done? Where should I have run the compiler? Well, what happens if I run it in directory? Let's see. What happens if I run it in directory A? What happens if I run this command in directory A? It's not going to find CB, right? So I don't want to be in directory B. I want to be in the parent of A and B, because then the class path will point to dot. And in dot are the directories A and B. Okay?
You could modify your class path variable and actually list those individual directories?
Yes, you could do that. Okay. Or, let's see. Okay, so here's the example. Class path defaults to dot. The search for the packages start in directory B. Class path needs to point to B's parent in order to find A. So I want to start searching from here rather than from here, which is what we just worked our way through. All right, and we can do that in a couple of different ways. The easiest way is to say, all right, my class path is back there. Up at the parent, I compile it, everything goes through. Notice I didn't have to compile CA. The compiler compiled it for me. That's an example of the automatic updating. Again, you need to, particularly if you're doing this manually like I do it, if you do it using an IDE, it will generally take care of this stuff for you. But I will point out why that's not such a good idea once we get through, if we get through in time. I will take time to rant at the end of the... Well, I could just go on for hours now because school is closed. All right, so that works. The alternative to using the class path command line argument is to use the class path environment variable. And, of course, the difficulty here is that every time you type Java C or you type Java, you have to specify a class path variable on the command line. And that's a pain if you're doing it by hand, unless you're using make or ant, which is actually something I forgot to talk about when we talked about Java tools. One of the things I should have talked about was using a build tool like make or ant. For the most part, IDEs will take care of that, so it wasn't such a big loss, but I should have mentioned it anyway. So what you can do is you can set the class path environment variable instead, and it contains the same data that you would put in the class path as an argument to the class path command line option. Java C and Java will use the contents of class path if you don't use the class path command line argument. And again, if you explicitly specify a class path for Java, make sure that if you need dot, you put it in there. You don't need to put dot in for Java C because dot is always there at the end, but you do need to actually specify it for Java if you need it. All right, any questions about that? Now, Horstman has a little section about why this is a bad idea. For the most part, I can understand why he says that, and I sort of agree with him. My argument against all of Horstman's arguments, well, you're dealing with idiots. You're dealing with people who don't know how to use class path correctly. But generally speaking, that's not a very good argument because people are what they are, and any argument that says that people should be something different is essentially doomed, no matter how much sense it makes or how correct you think it is. So you should probably listen to Horstman and try not to be an idiot with respect to how you use class path. It's actually not that hard to use it correctly. This one's a little tricky, but it's important, so I will mention it. And that's the idea of cumulative packages. The interesting thing here, and notice I said that, you know, the mapping between packages and directories is pretty natural, but packages are richer in the sense that, for example, you can have more than one package in the same directory. Here's another example of where packages are richer than directories. A package may appear in several class path directories. For example, I may have a user Java class path that contains java.lang, and I may have another class path, user local Java, that also contains java.lang. So now I have two packages that are named java.lang in different directories. The total package, java.lang, is the union of the individual packages. So for example, in this picture, I have three directories called java.lang, so the java.lang package is the union of the contents of this directory, and that directory. Okay, where these are the class paths, and then these are the package names.
What if each of those have conflicting methods in them?
Well, the methods aren't really the problem, it's the class names.
Oh, okay.
And we'll answer that on the next slide. Yes, I mean, that's a good point. What happens if I have string here and string there?
Right.
Well, what do you think would happen?
No.
Well, let's go and answer that. Cumulative package search. So essentially, you're asking the question, how do you search this if you have this kind of structure? The class search is sequential through the class path until the class is found. So the order in which you look at these individual packages depends on the order in which the class paths are listed in the class path value, either command line argument or environment variable. So for example, if you do it in alphabetical order, you'd look here first, and then you'd look here, and then you'd look here. Right. So if I had string here, and then string, that's actually the next point. Once you find what you're looking for, you stop. You don't search any further. All right? Now, this turns out to be a security problem, as you might expect, because essentially what that means is I have user Java package security, Java security cert certificate, right, my super secure certificate that guarantees I am who I say I am. And, of course, what happens is the evildoer comes in and interposes their directory before mine and then specifies in the class path evildoer Java before user Java, which means that the search for a certificate is going to stop at this point, and I'm going to get the evildoer certificate and not the certificate of goodness. Now, this actually turns out to be a bad example because the Sun people recognized this after they released it. Oops. So they had to cobble up some rules, which are in Horstman. I haven't found them yet. I was looking for them, but they're in there someplace, and I will find them. But this actually can't happen. I think it has something to do with if you have a package that starts with Java, like Java X or Java, then there are a restricted set of class path values that are valid for that. Right? Like I don't know exactly what they are, but there is a restricted set for which this will actually work. So if you try and do this, this won't work. But if you're not starting your package qualification with Java, then you have this problem. But it actually turns out not to be a problem. This also turns out to be a convenient way to interpose code with third-party libraries. Right, you buy a library from somebody, and it's not working quite right, and what you can do is you can put your stuff before the third-party library stuff so that your stuff will be intercepted before theirs. That turns out to be a really nice way to play with things. All right, do we have this is the last thing I guess we have to look at. All right, so that's pretty much all we need to know for package directories or packages in Java for this class. Anybody have any questions on that? And it's really important that you understand it, because if you don't, things can get really confusing, because all this stuff is going on in background. Right? And if something goes wrong, you're all of a sudden saying, what? What? Why didn't this work? And there's lots of things that could go wrong, as I pointed out along the way. So you really need to have a good understanding of what this stuff is. One of the things that can help you is the verbose class JVM option. Okay, and essentially this provides output that describes what happens when classes get loaded. Okay, unfortunately, it produces a lot of information, which you can see if you just run a program and give this option. And the other thing that drives me up the wall is it writes to standard out rather than standard error. So if you have a program that's producing output and you also want to run this, you're going to be in trouble because you have intermixture of outputs, which can be a pain. You can deal with it, but you have to grep and sed and all this other stuff. It's a pain. Here's an example. I run Java, the factorial program I sent around, and I say verbose class, and I get this kind of output. I loaded java.lang.object from shared objects file. This is from the jar file. Let me not say what it's from, but. And then I loaded java.math.big. Unfortunately, the program I sent around only loads from the well-known jar files, and it doesn't load anything local to the program, so you don't see what it looks like when you load local objects, but you can write your own code and see what it looks like. And there's a whole mess of stuff here. This is like two pages of output. I've elided here. And then you begin to see the output. You know, 1 factorial is 1, 2 factorial is 2, and then there's even more output down here. So this is one way that you can watch what the JVM is doing as it loads stuff in, and you can get some idea of where it's pulling all these class files in. See, I believe that's all right. So that's it. And so what I will do now is I will have a small rant on IDEs. If you're using an IDE like Eclipse or maybe Dr. Java, even certainly NetBeans, but NetBeans and Eclipse, the big ones, the big boys IDEs, they take care of all this stuff for you, which means that you don't have to think about it, which is really, really bad. Because what's going to happen is when you submit your code, I'm going to essentially say, make sure that you submit the following package directories. And you actually have to submit package directories. If you don't, your code won't compile. Right? And if your code doesn't compile, then your assignment fails immediately. Right? And what happens is people who run IDEs invariably will submit the project directory rather than the package directories I asked them to submit. And, of course, that doesn't work, and their code they fail. All right, so if you're using an IDE, that's no excuse. You really need to understand what the IDE is doing underneath. And in particular, you need to understand what the package directories are, because they're going to ask you to create specific package directories and submit them. Right, and if you don't, your code won't compile, because my turn-in code is looking for these directories, these package directories. And if it doesn't find it, it says, oops, that's it, we're done. So make sure you understand this stuff that we've talked about. Do not rely on your IDEs to do it for you. Because if you do, you're not going to be able to figure out how to submit. And like I said, this can go wrong. All kinds of things can screw up. So even if you get somebody else to do it for you and you never think about it, you still are at some point going to run into problems. And you need to be able to work your way through those problems. And if you just rely on your IDE to help you or to do it all for you, it's not going to work, because you're not going to understand what the IDE is doing. And the things you need to understand are really subtle. That's it. That's the end of my rant. Any questions? Seeing no questions, I'll see you next week. No class on Thursday.